Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
Hey guys, welcome to another edition of Happy Sad Confused. I'm Josh Horowitz, and this is my podcast. Welcome aboard if you're new to the show. Welcome back. Hopefully you've enjoyed past episodes, and hopefully you're going to enjoy this one. I know I did. This is, you know, it's a cliche to say. There are a few people they always talk about as like, this is the nicest guy in showbiz. And yeah, you hear the same names over and over again. Tom Hanks, and this guy, Hugh Jackman. Hugh Jackman. He really is. He's the coolest guy. I can't even tell you. What you see is what you get with Hugh. He is charming. He is clearly insanely talented. He sings, he dances, he acts, he does it all, including starring in a kind of a small production on Broadway right now. It's really cool. It's called The River. And we talk about this one a bit. It's a challenging play. It's edgy material. It's from a really talented playwright named Jez Butterworth. And it's, if you can get tickets, go out and check it out, because you have not seen Hugh do a role like this before. And the good news, as we talk a little bit about in the podcast, is that, despite it being clearly going to be a sold-out run, and it runs through early February, they're making tickets available each and every day. So go to the website for the show, The River, and get the details on how to get in to see it, because it's worth your time. As is this podcast, because, as I said, Hugh is super awesome in every conceivable way. We got a chance to kind of go down memory lane a little bit and talk about his beginnings. Getting, you know, Wolverine was the one that obviously made his career, and the story of how he got that and the struggle for that is fascinating. Plus, lots of cool stuff along the way, his ups and downs, and to the point where he is kind of ruling Hollywood with an iron, very pleasant fist. this was a treat. Hugh is somebody that I've been privileged to get to know the last few years, and to think that he took the time out from his very busy schedule to come by when he really didn't have to is it's a huge honor. So I hope you guys enjoy this one as much as I did. As always, guys, go over to wolfpop.com, check out our other shows over there. There's so much good stuff. Hit me up on Twitter, Joshua Horowitz. And in the meanwhile, the only thing you have to do, it's really easy, is sit back and enjoy this podcast interview with Mr. Hugh Jackman.
Is everything good?
Things are good.
Great.
Things are good. Busy but good, as they are
for you. So this is your office?
This is literally where the magic happens. This, you can see it. I'm bouncing off of a lot of silliness. This is a painting by Danny McBride of me.
Oh, really? That's fantastic.
So at the end of this interview, you have to obviously paint a...
Do something.
Something.
I'll just do it directly on the wall.
Yeah, exactly. Like a child.
I love it.
Like the child that you are. No, thanks for doing this, because obviously... congratulations. I saw you after the play recently.
Yeah, thank you for coming, man.
Oh, of course. And you don't...
Because I know you got nothing on.
I got nothing going on.
Lucky it's a short play.
That's right? Always good. I mean, you know, I know you don't have to do press for this. This must be a sold-out run. And are you enjoying it? How's it going?
Loving it. You know, I think... One of the reasons I want to sort of get out and tell people about it is, apart from the play, and Jez is one of the great playwrights out there, and I love the fact that everyone going in there has no idea what's going to happen.
Right.
But also I love what Sonia Friedman, the producer, has done, and Paul Libben at Circle in the Square, by offering tickets for everyone. You know, so there are, we release tickets each week for $35.
Yeah.
So if people want to see it, I was like one of those. I was one of the ones who queued up and did standing room only for shows.
I heard you talk about that for Huey, right?
Yeah. And so if there's people like that, I just love that they've made that available. And not just a few tickets, like a lot of tickets each
week. That's
awesome. So, yeah.
So. Yeah, and there, as I said to you, there's not, obviously there's not a bad seat in the house. It's a small theater. It's
8 rows back, which crazy. In any theater is a house seat, right?
Right.
That's your top seat. That's the back row. It's just so intimate, and I'm just loving doing that. It's been such a long time since I've done that. I mean, obviously when you're drama school and early on, everything's small, right? Because you can't feel it. But now it's such a thrill to go just back to that intimate space.
Is this as close as you get to kind of like the routine, like a day job, like your home, obviously? Yeah. You have a routinized schedule.
I love it. What's the politically correct term for it? I was thinking of something which is... But I'm a pack horse. Mm-hmm. I am quite, as an actor, I mean, I love the things that change, but give me a routine and I'm happiest. Yeah. Particularly this routine because I finish and I'm home and I sit on my son's bed and chat with him for half hour about his day, but I'm there when they come home from school.
Yeah.
I can be there in the morning. I can hang out during the day. So you feel like you're having 2 days in one. You're doing a job that I love going to work and I love being at home. So it's, or doing whatever.
So what are you finding, because you're probably a month or two in now, you've got a little more to go, obviously. How do you not go to autopilot mode? I mean, you've done these long runs before, obviously longer than this one even.
Yeah.
Do you have devices where you're directed.
It's the way you rehearse. Mm-hmm. So a director who leaves things really open for exploration might give you a color to play in a scene or a point of concentration rather than I need you to hit that. And when you do this line to get the laugh, you've got to say it like that. The more specific they are, the harder it is to break out of that and the harder it is not for it to feel routine. But it's literally like – okay, I can give you two analogies, see which one works for you. One is like if you're a golfer, it's the same game. You're hitting the same ball with the same clubs, but day one of a major or day two, you are wanting it to be better and better every time. You want to go deeper. You want to play that shot better. You're never fully satisfied.
Right.
The other analogy I have used in the past is sex. I mean, let's hopefully listeners are not going to have sex just once in their life.
Right.
Each time, right? It's great. That's what theater is. Theater is sex.
Do you feel like it's interesting because I have no follow-up on that, obviously. But I mean, you've done obviously such different kinds of shows where you do like this roaring big musical like Boy from Oz that has like the audience hooting and hollering throughout.
Yeah.
And this one, it's so still and you can hear a pin drop at times. Yeah. You must get off on that in a different way of 100%. Just hearing that silence and just everybody's in it.
In a way, there's something in common. There is an electricity in both. And it's that people always say, oh, do you do this for the applause? And weirdly, that's not as satisfying, the end or the standing ovation. That's not as satisfying as that moment when you know, mid-song, mid-scene, dance number, where everyone is in together, feeling it together. And in this play, there are really powerful moments. You can feel the goosebumps. You can feel that I have no idea what's going to happen and they're hanging on every word. And it's so it kind of feels the same. In a very different way, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
it's thrilling. And to be given these words by someone as great as Jez Butterworth is a rare thing.
I mean, I know you talked about this. I mean, theatrical productions are not they don't get up off the ground in 2 months. It takes planning, and especially with your crazy schedule. It kind of sounds like you've almost found a weird routine in that, like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like you're probably thinking in a year or two blocks where it's like, okay, I've got a play or a musical I want to do, and I'm going to take the best possible material around that. I mean, you've really prioritized making sure theater is always a part of it.
Well, that was a decision, a definite decision. And I have this incredible agent, Patrick Weitzel, who was like the young hotshot when I signed with him almost 20 years ago and now runs William Morrison as like, massive power broker. But right from the beginning, he's always said, you know, that you've got to stay true to your DNA, what speaks to you. And it's good to push yourself. But always, for me, it's going back to the theater, doing film, doing variety. That's always been what has got the best out of me. I find after I do a play, I go back on a soundstage and I am on a set and I am much sharper in front of the camera. There's something about the rigor of 8 times a week. You have to be in that zone, right? There's no like...
Yeah.
I'll come out of my trailer when I'm ready. You know, you've got to be on.
Yeah.
And it makes you much sharper and more disciplined in a way as an actor. And you get that feeling of the audience. But It actually, you're right. You've smartly looked at my career. It feels actually even more planned than it is.
Yeah.
Because it's like 2 or 3 year gaps. Regularly, I've gone musical play.
Right.
But that has been a little more happenstance. More, if anything, this the desire to keep all those options open and keep going back was from 15 years ago was the plan.
Do you find are you bad with downtime? Because it feels like the last couple times I saw you know you did the Tonys and literally I think it was the next morning you flew off, you did Pan.
Pan, yeah.
And then sounds like you probably didn't have much time off. That came right into this play.
Yeah.
X-Men.
I don't know if you're the same. Like you're always busy, right? I can actually look back to when I was 15, 4, 12. I was always busy.
Yeah.
Partly it's the youngest of 5 kids, and you watch your older brothers and sisters go play cricket and do this, and you're not allowed to yet.
Yeah.
And it's that feeling of, I don't want to miss out.
It's true. It's like even this podcast is like literally there's no reason for me to do this except I want to do it. And
well, that's
like
a great position to be in.
You know,
that's the greatest way to be busy. Sometimes in my life, I've been busy for the wrong reasons. You know, I've been busy because I did a job I didn't want to let someone down, you know, or I did it for someone else and that is when you can get into trouble. But generally, the things in my life that I'm doing, I really love it. And it is hard to find a balance, particularly with family and kids. And I like to think that I'm someone who's totally cool not working, but maybe I'm not. So I haven't really given it much of a go. Michelle's good.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of back body language to read in this room. We've obviously talked a lot, but we've never had the opportunity for like a long chat. So I want to talk a little bit of background. I mean, obviously, I'm just curious of like influences and sort of like what your first passions were growing up. Were you a movie geek? Were you was it theater first, movies or what, or both. Pop culture?
Both. My dad was into taking us to the theater. I don't think he was overly into it, but we grew up going to the theater and I loved it. I mean, when I was 18, I remember my birthday present was a season ticket to the Sydney Theater Company because I wanted, and I, that was once a month I went to go and see a new show, and I'd go on my own. And he bought me he's an accountant, he bought me the cheap package. So I was only allowed to go Saturday matinee.
Right.
So I was by far the youngest person in the audience, you know. And I used to love that, and I always did theater. I did musicals, I did plays. We would put on our own plays at school. So I was really into sport, but good at it, but not great. I was really into theater. I was better at that and all types of theater. And I loved movies. I never thought that being in movies was a possibility.
Right.
There was somewhere and I thought, okay, maybe I could be on stage or maybe that's a possibility. But even when I went to drama school, I was not thinking I was going to be in movies. That's been a complete surprise to me.
Were there examples around you? Like what were the first kind of people around you within even at least shouting distance that actually kind of were getting to where you wanted to be?
Hugo Weaving. But first time, for those who don't know Hugo Weaving, they were known from The Matrix or all those movies with the brothers.
The Wachowskis, is true.
Yes. Yeah. And he went to the school I went to.
Yeah.
And I was taken to the high school by my dad I was 10. And this is the school you're going to go to sort of thing. So he took me to a production of Man of La Mancha.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember buying the recording of it and listening to it over and over again. And I can still see his performance over how incredible he was. He would have been 16, 17 at the time. And I remember meeting him when I graduated from drama school and I was asked to do this thing at this event and he was there. And I was kind of really starstruck. And he's an amazing, amazing actor. That was the first time someone at my school from where I'm at had gone on to have a career.
Sure.
And that was the first time I thought it was possible. And I went to one of those kind of fancy schools where you're meant to be a lawyer, doctor, judge, that kind of thing. So, and acting was a hobby.
And
I always saw him and I was like, you know what? You can do it.
Was your family, was your dad's attitude, was he cool with the one he saw how passionate?
I didn't think he was going to be cool about it. I went to him. This is a good story because I auditioned for a drama school and I got in. And then I was so thrilled. I scraped in. I really did. I had to do like a couple of callbacks. And they told me, you're on the sort of waiting list. And I got in. And then the letter came the next day saying, you need to bring your check for $3,500, right? And I hadn't even thought. Because in Australia, a lot of education is free, right?
Sure.
Particularly when I was there. So university was free. And I went, oh, right, $3,500. Oh, well, and I literally tore it up, put it in the bin. And the day after, my dad's mum's bequest came in from her will, and it was $3,500.
That's crazy.
Crazy, right? And I'm like,
that'll make you believe.
And I'm like, in the garbage. I'm like, yeah, I'm meant to be doing this. But then I was like, I've got to tell dad. Like, I wonder what dad will think.
Right.
$3,500. And I went and I said, you know, this is what I want to use the money for, kind of thing. And, and he said, I couldn't think of a better way for you to use it. He was always big on education. And he said, you know, really, at one point I had a choice between being in a very popular soap opera, Neighbours at the time, or going to drama school afterwards, a full 3-year drama school. And I asked my dad his advice. And he said, I can't answer that for you. And I was like, ah, please, now don't give me your 21 and you make your own, just give me the easy
treat
answer.
Me like a kid for a second,
just
please,
for a second, please
tell me what to
tell
do,
tell me to go to bed. Something. And when I told him my decision to go to drama school, he was overjoyed. And I was like, why couldn't you have just shown me a little bit of that? Just a little bit. Why did you play poker so well? I had no idea what he thought was the right thing to do, but he was very supportive, always supportive. And you've seen my own show, but I tell the story of Carnegie Hall when he flew in literally 24 hours, right. Like he had 24 hours in New York, and that's 24-hour flight each way, either end, to go to Australia, to come and see that.
Yeah.
And I, you know, cut a long story short, I told him it was casual, but he wore a black tie he wanted to walk me to the stage door. And when I said, Dad, no one's wearing a black tie apart from the choir. And he goes, my son is performing at Carnegie Hall. That is black tie for me. And I remember seeing him actually in the, because at Carnegie Hall, you can see the audience. It's that opera kind of circular seating. And I could see him while I was sitting down crying.
Yeah. See, there's something that really like touches, like, because I was watching, you know, when I was reading up last night and watching some video, like I saw your acceptance speech for Boy from Oz, for instance, and it's like those connecting those moments where you're like, you're reaching this life goal, and then you see out of the audience, and it's like you see your dad, and it's just like it brings it all together, and it's like you're still that kid,
I'm still the kid who wants my dad's approval, and you know, want his, and that'll probably never go, hopefully in a good way. He's always been my rock and I think back now to the wisdom of that decision not to say anything to me.
Right.
Is amazing. But I don't know, if I didn't have him as a father and I hadn't had that example, and flash forward 10 years and my son's asking me, I'm telling you, I would have told him, no, do this, man. You know, but his faith, I suppose, in me, and also the patience and love to say, hey, if you're going to make a mistake, make it your mistake.
Right.
Don't make it my. You've got to make your own path now and live with it. It's a hard thing to do, but you know, he is a great man, kind of in the still waters run deep kind of category.
I'm curious. So, you know, in your 20s through drama school, and I know you know you get on some TV shows in Australia, you get some acclaim there. You get into Oklahoma, which is a big turning point, I would think. Right?
Huge.
Were you, before Wolverine, like, were you up for a lot? Were you doing a lot of Hollywood auditions? Like, were you ever close to anything?
No, I did like a general audition. Was I close to anything? No, I'm trying to think. Nothing. I literally just sort of signed because of Oklahoma and the stir that it made in America, because of being an American classic, and so it got reviewed. I got an agent off the back of that, but I was on stage. So I hadn't actually ever done the meetings and I put down it was my first audition, really, for an American movie. And so my agent was like, look, just keep going. People are seeing this. And I ended up doing about 6 or 7 auditions over a 9-month period. And I never really thought I would do it. But my agent was like, this is great. Look, Bill Mechanic, who was running 20th Century Fox, he goes, Bill Mechanic wants to actually do a proper film test, you know, with cameras and all that. So this is great. So it was a bit of a shock.
Well, that's the irony, is like, looking back, that was actually the casting against type for you. That was 100%. Not your career, what you were going for. You had just been in Oklahoma, and you're a foot too tall for the role.
Every way. And anyone who knows me knows that I couldn't be further from like Wolverine. I mean, even my kid. I've heard friends of Oscars say, oh, your dad, Wolverine. And he'll go, listen, I'm just going to be upfront. He's nothing like Wolverine. He is not cool. He's not tough. Nothing like that, okay? And just shuts it down immediately. And he's absolutely right. So in the kind of luckiest things that have ever happened to me category, being cast in that first was great. I mean, if I'd done, say I'd come here and done Boy from Oz first, I would never have been seen for it.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I think just the fact that nobody knew who I was probably helped.
It feels like it's kind of a – I wonder if today you would be cast in that role and just the environment that Hollywood's in right now. Like, right. Would, again, with also the fanboy service that's out, like, would they be so scared to, like, cast, again, this guy that's a foot too tall? Like, back in the day, it was like Bob Hoskins was the ideal for the role. Totally. Like, that was the guy that should have been.
Oh, man. And the effort that went to on X-Men 1 to make me look short. I swear to God, I never wore my shoes, ever, and I had trenches built. Jimmy Marsden had to stand on these, like, platform shoes. There is one shot in the movie where you can see his belt, and he looks so weird, like he's got his pants up, because he's actually standing, like, a six, and he's not a short guy.
This is the original Hobbit technology. This is the Lord of the Rings way back when.
And luckily, Famke and Rebecca, they were all really tall.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
only person on set who was allowed to be shorter than me was Anna Paquin. She was a kid, right?
So. Right.
We went to such effort, and there was such paranoia about it. But yeah, probably now, no.
Do you feel like you had a beat on it from the get-go? Like,
yeah, I remember even in that audition, I think I was probably in a grumpy mood. I was in a grumpy mood because I had to do the audition between shows.
Right.
And I ran from the theater to do it, and then I had to go back to the theater. And Oklahoma was a three-hour show, so it was a lot of singing all day, and I had two shows to do, blah, blah, blah. And I remember sitting there, and they were keeping me waiting, and they knew. And I'm like, you guys know I have to be back on stage. I have to go. And I actually went, and I said, guys, listen, I don't know where I'm at in the list, and I'm sure you're running behind. I've got to go.
They
in
probably
minutes.
Like that, because that's what Wolverine would be. He wouldn't suffer fools. He'd be like,
totally. And I remember,
fuck this. I got another thing to do.
I would like to see that tape. But I had a perm, for one. I was playing Curly. I literally had a perm. And because I wore a baseball cap. And the guys, take the cap off. I said, I don't think so.
I don't think it's going to help anybody. Nobody wants that.
No one wants that. And I went, I remember going there, go, can we just go? They said, do you want to? No, let's just roll tape. I've got to go in 5 minutes. Let's go. And I said, okay, done. Let's do the next one. And I think they'll be like, who is this dickhead? One, and B, he's perfect.
Exactly. Finally, a time when you want to be a dickhead and
get rid of the perm.
Right?
Actually, the feedback came, get rid of the perm and lose the Southern cowboy accent. Oh. You know?
Amazing.
How the hell I ever got cast. Unbelievable.
In the wake of that, it's interesting to look, like, you know, in retrospect now, like the films that you did after. I mean, how did you feel about, like, the choices you were making or the opportunities you were getting then? Because it feels like looking at the first few films after, you know, they're in all honesty, they're not the best films probably on your resume. But you then, in the middle of that, you have Boy from Oz. And then it feels like you click into, suddenly there's The Prestige and you're working with Woody Allen.
Yeah.
And it goes to another level, The Fountain.
It's true. I think at first, and I told you I have the greatest agent. And he was like, man, you got this hit and this thing, they're probably going to do another one. And I want to put you in some movies where the movie's not hanging on you. Because, and I've seen it, I don't want to give examples, you've seen many times someone has a hit and then all of a sudden they get given three movies and they come out in a year and career over, you know, if it doesn't work.
And when it feels like the public resents that, it's like, who decided this guy is, like, going to be our leading man?
Don't tell me.
We'll figure it out.
Exactly. And I did a number of movies which I really like doing, like Caden Leopold or Someone Like You or Swordfish, where it wasn't hanging on my name. And I got to, I had no experience in film, man. I'd done one TV series in Australia. I really had done nothing. And all of a sudden I was getting called, all these calls. And and if you look at those choices, I was really trying to do things that showed other ranges. You know? So that was that. And, you know, I don't think there was. It'll end up being the ones that people, you know, if they're doing retrospect of my life, they'll be doing those screenings. But I learned so much. I got a lot out of those. And, hey, Jim Mangold. That was a great movie. I really loved doing that movie.
That one stands out in that period, totally.
It does, actually. Yeah. And then Boy from Oz. What happened with Boy from Oz was when we opened, we got really bad reviews, which I don't read, but I was told. I mean, we had it. You know when you get a company meeting the day after the reviews and the producer comes in and goes, we really believe in this and we're not closing it yet? It was one of those. We stood in a circle and I'm like,
so they're all raves.
I should have read this review. Because I thought we were doing okay. People were telling me the audience seemed to be liking it. Anyway, it ended up being a big hit, but there was a ropey period there. But in that moment, I remember feeling totally at peace with it, even if it failed. And I had a lot of people, not my agent, but a lot of people who said, this is a bad idea for you to do.
Right.
But I just felt I had to do it. And it was a gut reaction. And weirdly, off the back of that, Darren Aronofsky cast me in The Fountain off the back of that. And Spielberg saw me do that and was the one who suggested me for the Oscars. And, I mean, Woody Allen's people. And it was all of these things where people saw a whole different side to me and gave me these avenues. And then that's when I clicked into, if you have the opportunity, work with the greatest directors you can.
Right.
And it was Nicole Kidman who told me that too. Nick was always like, if you get the option, work with the greatest directors. Because as an actor, it's not easy to get better in film.
Yeah.
It's not easy to challenge to get any better. You'll only get better if you work with great directors.
It's so true. I mean, to a man like the actors that I respect, I mean, I've said this for years. If you look at like what Tom Cruise did in the early years, he's working with Sidney Pollack and Scorsese and Oliver Stone. It's like that's the way to do it. Don't just like go for the payday. Go for
– Yes.
Just go for the talent. Exactly. Surround yourself by the best people and they'll make you look good.
Yeah, and I was inexperienced in film.
Yeah.
So I mean, Nolan and Woody Allen and Baz Luhrmann, these guys, Darren Aronofsky, I learned a lot about how to be on a set.
Yeah.
And I would say it took me 3 or 4 years. I feel in the last 3 or 4 years, the culmination of that, what I call my film acting school, was probably, thank God, 9 years. And I don't know if I deserve 9-year apprenticeship, but I got it, and I feel that that's starting to pay off now.
Is when you look at The Fountain, which I think is a profoundly beautiful film, emotional film, a wrenching experience for an audience member. Does it feel that way to you too? I mean, was the experience of that like it must have been extraordinary?
It was a life-changing experience, and profound is a great word for it. I'm still, to this day, so grateful to Darren and the memory of working with him. And every time I think of him, he's literally next to the camera lens and like a brother. That feeling of literally working with someone who's like a brother.
Yeah.
And he will go further than anyone. And he's like a general of the old school. And I won't tell who the actor is, but I never forget this actor going, I was about take 4 or 5. And Darren can be perfectionist, and he goes, oh, come on, you've got it, haven't you got it, Darren? And he goes, I don't understand why you don't want to do another one. He says, oh, come on. He goes, so hang on a sec, I've just spent however many years writing this, doing this, but this morning about an hour and a half lighting this for you to act. Isn't this what you want to do? Do you want to be in your trailer? Do you want to sit there? I thought you'd want to be here. And he treats that set like a cathedral, like a chapel, church, synagogue, anything. It's a sacred space. And that respect he has for actors and for the work, I have never forgotten. And that was a life-changing experience.
I mean, this is what you hear about somebody like, you know, he gets digs about his many takes, but like you hear about Fincher, and he always says, and he said to me and many others, it's like, this is for posterity. It's like we're there to make it as good as possible.
Totally.
I'm not trying to get to dinner quickly. I'm trying to make the best movie that will stand the best of time.
Yeah.
There's no argument.
No, I mean, on some level, I kind of admire the chutzpah of the people who are like, I've done a take. You got it.
Right.
I'm like, really? You think you're that good on one take? I'm not one of those guys. I'm the guy on the putting green who's like, give me another 100 balls. Like, I'm sure I can do that better. I know I'm going to go to bed, and that scene I'll never do again in my life.
Yeah.
Ever again. So I want to go to bed just going, I gave everything.
Another, I would call him a modern master, Christopher Nolan, Prestige, which is another just gem. Just to talk to me a little bit about he seems to be very, again, someone who knows how to do his job better than virtually anybody, and it takes it seriously. And what's the environment of
ease about him, even from the studio point of view? He makes these big studio movies, and the studio people will come and go, I'm meant to come and turn up, like I'm here, like there's nothing for us to do. It's just everyone crowds into the Daily trailer, and there's no notes to give him because it's all brilliant, right?
But, it's so annoying.
But I just have to turn up. And I remember them sitting there going, hi, you know. There's a real ease about him. Yeah. He wears the same overcoat every day, same shoes. I don't know if he still does that. And he finishes on time every day. I remember my lawyer at the time saying, oh, Hugh has this kind of trailer. I never get involved with that stuff. And Chris will ring my lawyer and say, hey, I'll do you a deal. I'm not going to give a full trailer to an actor. They're going to share a trailer. So Christian and I had a half trailer each. He says, but I'll promise you that he will never be sitting in that trailer for more than 15 minutes.
Nice.
And he was true to his word.
And even on that, which is, I mean, not a small film. I mean, it's a
big film. Yeah. And all on, like, hey, shot in Los Angeles for England. I mean, it was unbelievable. And he gives you a freedom to do your thing. He loves you to create a character, but you just have this great safety net of knowing that he has this incredible taste. And if you're going off a little bit too much, or again, right. I learned a lot about film acting from him too, and how you need to make it your own and how you need to create a full character, that you've got to do the homework.
Right.
You've got to bring that to set. And 10% of what you give, he'll guide you this way, but 90% he'll just let you fly.
He's someone that's always worn his influences of I know he's like a huge James Bond fan. I'm waiting for one day. I feel like one day he will actually make a James Bond
film. I'm sure he will.
Which will be amazing. Insane. Of course, yeah.
By the way, I remember getting after I hosted the Oscars, he gave me a handwritten note because he was there. It was the year with Heath.
Probably Inception or Dark Knight. Yeah, Dark Knight.
And his note meant probably more to me than anyone because he's one of those, a bit like my dad. He doesn't give the praise easily.
Right.
But when it comes, you never forget it.
Was speaking of Bond, there was talk. Is this one of those old wives' tales? Was that ever something that you came close to doing, or they said that you turned it down? Or what?
No. What happened was my agent said that he had had a call from the Bond people asking if I was interested.
Right.
You know, that typical Secret Service kind of thing.
Right.
I've since chatting to other drunken Brits, actors. Five or six people got that phone call, Daniel being one of them. Mm-hmm. Daniel went for it. At the time, I just didn't, and I really thought about it. I actually remember ringing Russell Crowe to get his advice on it. I was, because I'd always, in a way, dreamt
that's hard to
Bond,
say
but
no
I
to.
Just started the X-Men thing,
right.
And that had taken off, and I was like, my life would be Bond. I mean, hey, high-class problems, but I was quite obsessed with that time about variety.
Yeah.
So,
do you I mean, obviously, in the last few years, we've talked a lot about this Wolverine character who, like the character itself, will never die for you. Clearly, he just keeps going and going and going, which is amazing.
Will, Josh,
well, doesn't seem close at hand. You're working on another solo project, another Wolverine.
Yeah. Jim Mangold and I are working on it really hard, and I'm very, very excited about that, actually.
Yeah. So you're factoring somewhere into X-Men Apocalypse, right? You're going to pop in there somewhere.
You know, I have been speaking to the guys, and I am not at liberty to tell exactly what's going okay. on, which is largely framing my answer here, but there's still a lot unknown, actually, about that.
So what?
But I do know there's some very exciting things about integrating the whole X-Men world, including the Wolverine movie. So there's some really cool things going on.
Yeah, I got the chance to talk to Oscar Isaac the other day, who's playing Apocalypse, the bad guy, which is awesome.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah. Do you still geek out about, like, I mean, just again, as a film fan, like, he's also in Star Wars, and like, everybody, like, I watched the Star Wars trailer, like, 15 times.
Yeah,
like,
right.
I'm like still 12 years old.
Yeah.
Like, do you get excited? I mean, have you become a little jaded knowing how the sausage is made?
If it's Star Wars or Indiana Jones, I still turn into a geek.
Yeah.
Because that's what they're the turning points for me.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones when I was 12. Yeah. You can laugh now. That's right.
No, I'm Indiana Jones. I've got the fedora right here.
Nice.
What a segue you just did.
I love it. Perfect.
In our last couple seconds here, moments here.
Yes.
There's some random questions.
Oh, I love
in there.
It.
Do you want to pick one or two?
I'd love to. Okay.
Here we go.
Favorite cartoon character? Superman. Growing up with Superman.
The cartoon was
Doom?
Super Friends.
But there was a Hall of Doom that came out of a swamp.
Yeah, yes. That was the bad guys.
Yeah, bad guys. Were they the Hall of Doom?
There was the Fortress of Solitude.
Yes.
We're very rusty.
Love it. That was my favorite Saturday morning go-to.
Nice.
I like Plastic Man as well. I thought he was funny.
Good. You know who was going to – the Wachowskis were going to do a Plastic Man movie way back when. Way back when.
Really?
Yeah, they had a script and everything.
Really?
Yeah.
I can't, and then –
then Matrix got, you know, sidelined a little bit. This little
good
film.
Choice.
Yeah, exactly.
They went with the Matrix. Beard or mustache? Oh, beard.
You're gifted in that you can, I mean, pan Blackbeard. Oh, this is funky going on.
That had a little sort of goatee, but that was a serious mo. That was a serious mo into the whole thing. And the greatest thing about it, I spent 3 days at Disney World with my daughter and three of her friends for a birthday.
Not recognized?
Not one.
Amazing.
Not once. Literally not once. to the point where I actually was like, hey, it's me. No, I'm kidding.
Is Deb at this point just sort of like, whatever they do to your face, fine. I've seen it all.
Oh, yeah, no. She's like, great. It's like having an affair every 3 months. But she was most thrilled that I wasn't being recognized. She loved that.
It's amazing.
I mean, to walk into Harry Potter world, it was just awesome.
Which is amazing, by the way.
Having my butter beer. Bring it on. Have you had butter beer? Oh, my God.
It's not as good as it sounds, I will say.
I couldn't even get through the whole thing.
It's very sweet.
Oh.
I don't think it's allowed with your – I've seen your Instagram workouts.
It is not allowed, mate. None of that. That is probably 11,000 calories.
It's about like 1 o'clock or something. How much have you bench pressed today? How many people have you just lifted over your shoulders?
So many. How many have I eaten is what you meant to say. Yeah, I've done a bit. Who knows what's coming up next year? So okay. I'm a skinny guy by nature, so part of my fear is I'm really healthy. I have a great trainer who, like, I used to have dodgy knees because in the early days I try and get into shape too quickly. Right. And now, so there's a few things like a bench press, a deadlift, and a squat. And if I have a number to hit, and if I don't hit that, I feel like I'm off the wagon and right. It's just going to be a declining slow or quick downhill. And by the way, that time will come probably sooner than we all think where I won't need to do it, and you watch how fast I fall off. And you'll be like, who is that skinny guy walking around?
He was going to bench press me a few times and go off to do another show today and probably shoot another movie in his downtime. Thanks for stopping by, though, man.
It's always a pleasure, man. Thank you. And congrats on all you did. And I love that you didn't have to do this. I love that.
This is fun.
You.
I mean, hello.
Thank you, buddy.
Good to see you, buddy.
Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.